Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in New York against Upplinger and Butler. Mr. Akari, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The present cases are before you on a writ of certiorari to the New York Court of Appeals. That court, in a memorandum decision last year, found unconstitutional New York Penal Law Section 23540 Subdivision 3. That statute is generally referred to as the loitering statute in New York, and it generally prohibits individuals from loitering or remaining in a public place.
Mr. Arker, could I ask you a question about the procedural posture of this case? You're the district attorney of Erie County, which I guess is Buffalo.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But you represent the state in this case.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Now, the Attorney General of New York has apparently taken a partial fall in this case. He's filed a brief where he says, maybe to minors, but now you're speaking for the state of New York in this case, not him, I take it.
That's correct, Your Honor. Generally, that statute prohibits individuals from...
Well, you're not speaking for the Attorney General of New York, though.
No, I disagree with the Attorney General.
Well, I know. I know you do. So.
And,
but he...
Well, Your Honor, he doesn't have the responsibility of enforcing this law either. I'd like to also point that fact out, that I have the responsibility of enforcing this law. And I had no knowledge
that... And you have the authority to represent... You can't speak for the state of New York, can you? Can't you just speak for the county or what?
No, Your Honor. I'm speaking on behalf of the state of New York.
Because you have the authority to do that.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But only he has to run for election statewide.
I have to run also, Your Honor.
But not statewide.
That's correct, Your Honor. And by the way, I may add that I had no knowledge that the Attorney General was going to file that brief until the day in which the respondents were to file their brief. That was the first time that I had any notice at all that the Attorney General was going to take this position contrary to mine. In fact, he was invited to participate in this case at the Court of Appeal, the Court of Appeals, and he refused. So this case came...
Do you have some state requirement that the Attorney General has to be vouched in whenever there's an attack on the constitutionality of New York statute?
Under the executive law, Your Honor, it says that the Attorney General can appear in court to defend the constitutionality of a statute.
Some states have statutes which provide that when in any action in the state, a question of the constitutionality of a state statute is raised, then the parties must vouch the Attorney General into the case to let him come and defend the constitutionality of the statute.
Your Honor, he has that option. Either appear to defend the Constitution.
But are you required to give him notice?
We did give him notice in this case, Your Honor.
Aren't you required to if the constitutionality of the law is at stake? And
yes,
then he has the option.
That's correct, Your Honor. He has refrained from exercising that option until the case came before this.
So after he got the notice, he never told you he was going to appear.
No, he didn't, Your Honor. He had no knowledge. This statute, generally referred to as the loitering statute, prohibits individuals from loitering or remaining in a public place for the purpose of soliciting or engaging in deviant sexual intercourse or other sexual behavior of a deviant nature. Now, briefly, the facts underlying the two cases before the court are as follows. The respondent, Butler, who was a known prostitute to the Buffalo Police Department, was observed for approximately 10 minutes on a public street in the city of Buffalo waving at passing automobiles. She ultimately entered one of those automobiles, which then proceeded down a side street. The police officer who was making those observations then went to where that car was parked and observed the respondent, Susan Butler, engaged in an act of oral sodomy with the driver of that vehicle. She was then arrested under the loitering statute. Mr. Upplinger was arrested on a public street in a quiet residential area of the city of Buffalo following a direct and overt solicitation to a plainclothes Buffalo police officer to engage in an act of oral sodomy. The police action in both of these cases was the result of a reaction by the police department to citizen complaints of these type of activities occurring in those two respective neighborhoods. I will go into a little more detail on the facts of the case during the course of my argument. At issue here is whether or not this statute represents a valid attempt by the state to control public order. Our position as the petitioner is that the state enactment is valid as based upon a legitimate and a compelling interest in the control of the conduct that it prescribes. Now, with regard to the compelling state interest, first, I submit that the solicitations that we are talking about here constitute a real harassment. They are a real annoyance to the general public. They are conversations of the most intimate nature. They are the most private of matters, and they are delivered in a public forum.
Well, Mr. Arcara, that may be true, but apparently the New York Court of Appeals placed a construction on the purpose of the statute that was more limited than that, said that it was not a statute intended to protect the harassment of other people in the vicinity, but rather was in the nature of the companion attempt statute to another law which New York courts had held unconstitutional. Are we bound by the determination of the state court as to the purpose of this statute?
No, Justice O'Connor, and I dealt with that issue in point four of my reply brief.
I was afraid you might have dealt with it incorrectly, and that's why I asked the question.
Well, Your Honor, I submit that the Court of Appeals applied no statutory construction to that statute. They merely invalidated it in total. And then they gave some reasons for it, which I submit.
Well, the court spelled out what it said the purpose was and was not. Are we bound by that?
No, Your Honor, because the court, in making its finding, relied upon the Onofre decision. And that decision relied upon the right of privacy and the Equal Protection Clause. And they interpreted the federal constitution regarding the applicability of that statute to the state law. And I submit that this court is the final arbiter as to whether or not the federal constitution, as it was applied to a state court, was applied correctly. And I submit they did not apply it correctly.
Do you think in interpreting the New York Court of Appeals opinion, we may read the opinion in this case in the light of its Onofre opinion?
Well, Your Honor, as far as they, I don't think you have to. I think we're talking about here a public nuisance. And I personally think that the Onofre decision was totally of another matter. And the right of privacy that they use in that case, that dealt with private acts of adults in a private setting. Here we are talking about an harassment statute on a public street in a public area that is annoying and to the public at large. And it's so offensive that I submit that the legislature had a right to enact this law and to protect the public from these types of infringements on their rights.
But, counsel, here we're dealing with an opinion of New York's highest court that's a little over a page long.
That's correct,
and
Your Honor.
It doesn't cite any constitutional provision. It cites the penal law. Unless one is to go back and look at People versus Onofre, which they refer to, it's almost impossible to tell on what grounds they did away with the statute.
It is very difficult, Your Honor. I agree. But
so then don't you think People against Onofre shed some light on it?
Well, People versus Onofre was dealt with the right of privacy and equal protection, and I don't believe that the right of privacy in a home, in a private setting of a home between consenting adults, would apply to the privacy that a person is entitled to on a public street. And secondly, the Equal Protection Clause, I don't think has any application here whatsoever.
Well, this court denied cert on that case.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Do you think the New York Court of Appeals held this statute was unconstitutional?
It would have to, Your Honor.
Well, I would think it would have to, too, but it doesn't say so.
Well, it's very difficult, Your Honor. I wrestled with that decision for many, many hours as to what they were trying to say. I don't think they did anything to try to construct that statute in harmony with the Constitution. They didn't look into what the intent of the law was. They didn't deal with the purpose of the law was. They just kind of, in a summary fashion, just said this was an act that was anticipatory of a legal act, and therefore we are going to say that it's unconstitutional. I think that's what they said.
But they didn't say what they acted on.
He thinks that they acted on the overbreath, that they felt that Justice Jason felt that the court was applying the law from the setting of a private setting of a home or a private residence to the street, and he felt that it was an overbroad interpretation of the statute, Your Honor.
Well, possibly the court based it on either the right of privacy inquiry or possibly a First Amendment problem. Is that
I don't
right?
believe there's any reference at all to the First Amendment. I don't believe that was the case at all, Your Honor. It strictly dealt with the right of privacy, well, in conjunction with the First Amendment, I'm sorry, and as far as the Equal Protection Clause is concerned.
The only intimation I find in the opinion of the New York Court of Appeals in this case as to some constitutional ground is it says this statute, therefore, suffers the same deficiencies as did the consensual sodomy statute. Now, that takes you back to Onofre, and there they are talking about federal constitutional rights. It seems to me that your best chance to get a review of this decision on the merits in this court is to agree that this decision should be looked at in the light of Onofre.
I agree, Your Honor.
Okay.
Secondly, these type of solicitations could also lead to a violent reaction. And beyond the fact that they are foisted upon an individual in a public setting, they are so intimate in nature that I submit that a violent reaction could be generated by a solicitee when someone addresses his sexuality in a public street. I further believe, regarding the compelling state interest here, that there is a real effect on minors, that there is an incident in the record, and I make this claim based upon what is in the record, that a mother was concerned about her son being apprehensive about going out into the street following being solicited to engage in an act of oral sodomy. I submit that there is a potential harm when the sexuality of a minor is addressed in a public street, not with the consent of the minor or his parent, but strictly is to the arbitrariness and discretion of a pure stranger. Thirdly, I submit that this law acts as a deterrent to those minors who would solicit, either voluntarily or through coercion. And further, it prevents minors from being exploited by those who would seek to satisfy their own sexual desires. Lastly, I submit that we are dealing here with a public nuisance. The record clearly establishes that businessmen were concerned about congregating groups of solicitors, and they believed that there was a problem, that senior citizens and elderly people were somewhat apprehensive about going into the neighborhood, to the stores, and to the restaurants that were located in that area, and that the citizens were apprehensive about walking outside their homes for fear of being solicited. What you have in the posture of this case here is that these individuals have taken over the area of Genesee Street in the city of Buffalo, have taken over the area of North Street in Delaware and North Street and Irving Place. Having set out these compelling interests of the state, the speech and the conduct that we are here concerned with now can be examined as it relates to the First Amendment. First, in regard to the content of this solicitation, I don't think it can be disputed that the communications that we're dealing with here are not ideas. They are not discussions of the issues or of opinions. There is no search for the truth here. These are no way at all man's or a pursuit by man for his higher pursuits. I submit that at the minimum, these solicitations are lewd, and perhaps they may be obscene. These are not a four-letter sexually explicit epithet emblazoned upon a jacket of an individual to denote some political position. These are solicitations which are wholly erotic in nature and are merely meant to satisfy the personal and the selfish sexual desires of the solicitors. Much of the conversations that we are dealing with here deal with the crime of prostitution, and I submit are clearly not protected. We submit that certainly an argument can be made, a strong argument I submit, that this type of speech should be denied all constitutional protection based upon the content. However, if somehow this speech is minimally protected with respect to the content, then I submit that in the context in which it is uttered, it clearly prohibits the invocation of the First Amendment. We're talking about a public street here. There's no right to privacy involved here. The solicitations are not occurring in one's home. These are in a public area that belong to the citizens of that community. They are delivered indiscriminately, with the key here that they are delivered without any indication at all on the receptiveness on the part of the solicitee. As noted earlier, these solicitations involve the most intimate of matters, and they are made without the consent of the solicitee. Last and most importantly here, the solicitee's rights of privacy have been infringed upon. He is not only a captive listener here, but he is forced to compel or forced to respond, even if by an abrupt avoidance. Someone directs a solicitation at that person. I say that that's much more intimidating than even in Colfax or in Larimer, where you can, the conversation was not directed at you personally. Your sexuality now becomes a topic of conversation with someone who may be a total stranger to you. Now, with regard to the overbreath, Mr. Uplinger claims here and suggests that the statute overreaches with respect to his conduct as reflected in the record.
Placing its decision on overbreadth.
No, but the respondents raised that issue, Your Honor, in their brief, so I thought that, that the court here may want to deal with that. I would like to go back to the facts regarding the solicitation by Mr. Uplinger. We have a Buffalo police officer who is standing on the steps in a private or in a quiet residential area of the city of Buffalo. Mr. Uplinger approached the Buffalo police officer and after the initial greetings then said to him, "Do you want to get high?" The police officer responded in the negative, "No." Then a group of other individuals came over and they were involved in a conversation. When a police vehicle arrived and the police officers inside asked the individuals to get off the steps and to leave the area. At this time, the Buffalo police officer separated himself from Mr. Uplinger and walked away from Mr. Uplinger. Mr. Uplinger then followed or pursued the police officer and asked him if he would come over to his home. The police officer responded, "What for?" He just says, "Why don't you come over?" The police officer then said, "I'm afraid with the police. I just want to leave." This is the second time that the police officer refused an offer by Mr. Uplinger. At this point in time, and I submit in an offensive way, and I submit without any receptiveness on the part of the police officer, Mr. Uplinger asked the police officer to come over to his house to engage in an act of oral sodomy. I submit here that the real argument that my opponent is addressing with this overbreadth question is that they are saying that since these type of solicitations don't bother them, and therefore, the public must tolerate them. Similarly to a publicly intoxicated person who would say that public intoxication doesn't bother me, why should it offend you? If there is one instance where there may be a possible overbreath, I submit, that is if an individual were to loiter in a public place with another person, and that person is not a minor, and he knows that the solicitee is receptive. In that one instance, I submit that there could be a possible overbreath.
Well, Mr. Arcara, I still don't understand why we're talking about overbreath in view of the Court of Appeals' clear statement that it wasn't basing its decision on that, and I assumed we were here to review their decision.
Okay.
Now, for purposes of your argument, do you assume that there is a right of privacy as articulated in Onofre? You make that assumption and nevertheless urge that this statute need not be held invalid.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, certainly the assumption that Onofre was correctly decided is contrary to our summary affirmance of the Doe case in 1976 from the Eastern District of Virginia, isn't it?
That's correct, Your Honor.
But the merits of the Onofre case were not briefed here in this court or argued by...
No, we submitted a petition for cert and it was denied.
Right. And so that really, I assumed, wasn't before us, that you were assuming somehow that Onofre was correct and there was the right found in that court of privacy, but that this statute... The attempt statute, if you will, was nevertheless valid, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
I'd like to go on at this time with the question of vagueness.
May I ask you a question before you proceed? Is there any legislative history that sheds light as to the purpose of this statute?
No, Your Honor. We do cite in the in my brief the Model Penal Code that indicates what the purpose of the statute was, and that is that it was a harassment statute.
Well, was there any evidence in the legislative history that that was its purpose?
No, Your Honor, there wasn't.
In the dissenting opinion, there is a statement that every indication is that this statute was designed to regulate public conduct, which would be considered offensive. There's no citation or documentation of that. Do you have any in mind?
No, Your Honor.
But apparently the majority of the New York Court of Appeals felt that it did not view the legislative purpose to be the deterrence of harassment. But nonetheless, I suppose you would perhaps say that this statute that we're looking at was an effort to control certain public conduct rather than conduct in private.
That's correct, Your Honor. With respect to the vagueness question, I submit that there is no possibility for arbitrary enforcement of the statute. Police officers, I submit, would not be able to arrest strictly on a whim or a guess if someone were merely standing on a street corner. But that they would...
Vagueness because your opposition has said the statute is vague?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Not because the Court of Appeals said it was.
No, Your Honor.
Because as a respondent, they have raised vagueness.
They raised the question, Your Honor.
On the ground, and on that ground, they urge it be affirmed. You're the respondent.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Or the appellee, or whatever you are, the respondent.
Due process would require that for an arrest that there be an articulable overt conduct, which would demonstrate the individual's mental state before arrest could occur. In the case of Mr. Uplinger, you have a direct solicitation. In the case of Susan Butler, you have her loitering, waving in automobiles, followed by an observation that she was engaged in an act of oral sodomy. Furthermore, due process would require that before a conviction that there would be proof beyond a reasonable doubt. I submit that there would be no discriminatory enforcement based solely upon anyone's status regarding this case. There is no indication in the record or the face of the law that it is directed at anyone's status. In fact, the clear language of the statute relates only to conduct and activity and not sexual preference or any criminal reputation.
Mm-hmm.
The respondents also raised the question regarding notice, and they allude to the other behavior of a deviant nature, which is the second severable part of that statute. I submit that this challenge to the portion of the law under which he was not charged is not a facial challenge. It is a challenge to a severable part of the law which has not been charged, and therefore she is precluded from raising that question under precedent of this court. In regard to the last issue, and that is under inclusiveness, the opponent suggests that the New York statutory scheme is flawed because it prohibits solicitations for deviant sexual intercourse and not normal sexual intercourse. I submit that New York does prohibit solicitations for normal sex under the general harassment statute. And that statute, however, does require an intent to harass. I believe what occurred here, that the legislature felt that this type of conduct was so offensive to the general public that they decided to make this a strict liability statute. In conclusion, I ask that this court act on behalf of the citizens of New York and their right not only to privacy but tranquility in their neighborhood, and that I ask that you reverse the judgment of the New York State Court of Appeals.
Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I agree with my opponent that this was a constitutional adjudication below. I don't believe that needs to be proved, but if there is any need for proof of it, one need only look at the record. The only issue that was raised in the lower courts and presented to the Court of Appeals was a constitutional challenge.
Based on the United States Constitution?
The challenge was based on both the United States Constitution and the state constitution.
And what was the case adjudicated on?
One can't determine that by looking at the Uplinger decision by itself.
No, but Onofre. How about Onofre?
The Onofre decision was adjudicated solely under the United States Constitution.
Right. And here they relied on Onofre.
Yes. That's what they said in their decision. And I have no doubt, therefore, that they made this adjudication under the federal Constitution as well. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that some of the problems we have procedurally at this point is that both counsel for both parties have some difficulty, as I'm sure the court does, in the brief opinion that was written by the Court of Appeals in knowing exactly what they were saying. However, there were some things that they were saying that come through very clearly. And while that has been mentioned briefly, I want to emphasize that the state is asking this court to go beyond its jurisdiction. I might also say that the state has varied its position with regard to whether the court below construed the statute or not. If you will look at the petition for certiorari at page 6, you will see the following quotation. The state argued there that the statute, and I'm quoting, contrary to the conclusion of the New York Court of Appeals, was not limited just to consensual sodomy, anticipatory conduct. In other words, in the petition for certiorari, they were saying what I say, which is that the Court of Appeals did construe the statute. When it got into the main brief, they were saying somewhat the same thing, as I indicate in my responding brief. And then when they got to the reply brief, as a result, I believe, of my having raised the issue in point 2 of my brief, they come up with the concept, which I am not certain I fully understand, that is based upon, I believe, a misreading of the decision Ward and Gall versus Krinsky. They suggest in the reply brief, by a quotation from that case, that this court, while it may be bound by a construction of a state statute, is not bound by the reasoning in reaching the decision that this court reaches. And then they state in their brief that, therefore, if the legislature's intent was different from what the Court of Appeals said it was, that this court is not bound by the Court of Appeals' decision.
Let me ask you, suppose
a person on the street in a public place, it solicits two people to engage in an act of oral sodomy, or act of sodomy, and both of them say, please leave me alone, you're annoying me. And they immediately call a policeman and say, this man is soliciting me contrary to the statute. Now, on what ground under the Court of Appeals decision would you say that that person could not be convicted?
I would say that the ground would be that the Court of Appeals has construed the statute as being limited to a smaller, if I may use the word, geographical area than what you're talking about. It was not designed to reach offensiveness per se. It was designed as one of the levels of inchoacy behind the consensual sodomy statute. Behind the consensual sodomy statute, originally you had the solicitation.
So you're saying you couldn't be convicted under the statute even if you were annoying people by your solicitation?
Your Honor, I haven't thought that through. I'm not sure. But you could be convicted under another statute, which is the harassment statute,
well,
under the facts you provide.
Well, really?
I want to know whether you could be convicted under this statute.
If you take the construction of the New York Court of Appeals...
I can see that perhaps... suppose the person first solicited a person who says, please leave me alone, you're annoying me, and refused. He solicits another person who is very willing. He is then charged with two counts of illegal solicitation under this statute. Now, could he be convicted under the New York Court of Appeals opinion? Could he be convicted on either one or both?
I believe that the way this statute is written and the way that the New York Court of Appeals has construed it, he would not be convicted under this particular statute at the present time. On either count. However, the New York Court of Appeals has made it clear that that kind of conduct could be subject to conviction. I cite the Phipps versus Ohio case as an example of the kind of fact pattern, Your Honor, that you have cited.
I can't believe that that you say this is a constitutional decision. All you're saying is that in my example, you're just saying, well, neither of those acts under either of those counts is covered by the statute. The New York Court of Appeals has just construed the statute not to cover either one of them, and yet you say this is a constitutionally based decision.
What I've said is this.
And if you're going to, you can't have it both ways. It can't be both ways. I don't blame you for arguing that this is just a case of statutory construction, but I thought you said that this, and I certainly read the Court of Appeals opinion as being having a constitutional issue in it.
I thought counsel did too.
I don't believe, first of all, I'm convinced that the Court of Appeals decision was a constitutional adjudication. It had no jurisdiction to...
Well, why did it have to reach a constitutional issue if it just construed the statute not to cover either one of the situations that I outlined in those two counts?
Well, because, Your Honor, it was faced with a fact pattern that is totally different from what you were talking about. It was faced with a fact pattern of an individual who extended a private invitation to go to his home and engage in...
It may be private, but can you imagine that when he solicited an undercover police officer that he was engaged, it was sort of a consensual matter?
I don't think that the determination of the consensual matter can be judged on the identity of the police officer, which was not known to the respondent at that time. It has to be gauged in terms of the kind of a role the police officer was playing.
He can just take his chances on it, solicit anybody he wants to as long as he doesn't know. He isn't annoying anybody just by soliciting anybody on the street.
Your Honor, that is not what I say at all, and that's not the facts in this case.
Well,
what the people are saying is that there is a per se absolute prohibition, which is constitutionally permissible, that no man or woman can ever have this kind of a conversation with any other person anywhere in the state of New York under any circumstances.
Well, that is an overbreadth argument, isn't it?
I believe that overbreadth is necessary here, and I don't understand.
Well, if it's necessary, the Court of Appeals didn't think it was.
I understand.
That's not the state's case. The state says it can't be done in public. In public.
The state makes the claim, Your Honor, that it can't be done in public under any circumstances.
Yes.
except one, what it says is a limited circumstance if two people were in a remote place and no one else was around, which I submit is the general situation. In these kinds of situations, as pointed out in the UCLA Law Review article cited in a couple of the amicus briefs, I think that the problem that we're facing here has to do with the kind of characterization that the state gives the court. The thought that homosexuals have taken over this particular area or what have you. The fact is that if two homosexuals had met, first of all, that's not true, but be that as it may, if two homosexuals had met each other and had a private conversation in that particular area with no one around who could hear anything, under the state's analysis, the problem that they're facing, as he sees it, is that they've taken over.
How would that case ever come up if no one's around and they're both consenting? It
would only come up in the way that this case has come up, through an undercover police officer, which is another way of indicating that the only way that you have offensiveness in the typical situation is where somebody has blatantly posed the question right up front at the very beginning and has not, through a process of acquaintanceship, become attuned to the fact that the other person is receptive to the conversation that's going to occur.
Mr. Gardner?
Yes, sir.
Do you agree with me on my understanding of the New York Court of Appeals opinion, which I'm about to state to you, that they say in Onofre, we held that you cannot criminalize the act of deviant sexual intercourse, and that's their language. The statute under consideration in Uplinger prohibits solicitation of that sort of intercourse. Since you can't criminalize the act, the state can't prohibit the solicitation either.
I'm not sure they said that this prohibits the solicitation.
Pretty close to a quote.
All right. I was only going to draw the point that it is a loitering statute. I didn't recall that they claimed that it was a solicitation statute. But what is clear is that it is an inchoate invitation to engage in an act of conduct in a private place which was not illegal. And the question I think that they were facing is it's
not illegal only in the sense that the New York Court of Appeals has opined that the legislature can't make it illegal. In Onofre.
I pointed out in my brief, Your Honor, that it's not illegal after the Onofre decision, as a matter of adjudication in that case, whatever the rule may be in this court's opinion with regard to the correctness of that case.
I don't
believe you need to reach that.
Well, but
issue.
I don't know that I agree with you, because if one of the pins of the New York Court of Appeals opinion in this case is the validity of its Onofre decision, we obviously can't review Onofre, but we can certainly review the constitutional law that's laid down in Onofre.
I would agree that you have that power. What I would say that it may not be appropriate to do it under the circumstances that you're presented with in this case. I have referred to the Gates decision in my brief, and I submit that should be reviewed and thought about. The one thing that I would emphasize, please, is that we do not have a record here that would give Your Honor and the Court sufficient information to make the kind of judgments and evaluations as to whether the Onofre decision was correct in terms of the social impact, in terms of the degree of participation in the kinds of sexual activities that we're talking about, things of that sort.
Mr. Gardner, assuming that is correct and we shouldn't address the correctness of the Onofre decision. Nevertheless, if there is any right as recognized in Onofre, and assuming for this purpose that there is, does that right extend to prohibiting the state from controlling attempts made in public? And why should the right to privacy or to do things in private extend on to doing the same or some portion of those things in public?
I don't believe that Your Honor, I don't believe that the right of sexual privacy that Onofre talked about is the right that protects my client in terms of his conversation with someone else in a public place. I believe that the right we're dealing with here falls under the rubric of the First Amendment freedom of speech, subject to all of the power of regulation that is appropriate under that particular amendment. There has been suggestions in some of the amicus briefs that the right of sexual privacy may be impaired or burdened in some way if the court does not allow some very limited controlled public conversation about the private right. I would suggest to you that if you limit it, if you balance the interests as between the right of the speaker to speak and the right of the hearer to have an acceptable environment, as Justice Stevens indicated in the Bolger case last year, if you balance those interests in the area of sex, it's going to be obvious that any exercise of the right of free speech is going to have to be subject to consideration for the acceptability of that speech to the person you're speaking to, consideration for the sensitivity of the public at large. I would only point out to you that what the state wants to say is that you can't talk about it at all. You can't discuss this subject if it includes an invitation to come home. I'm saying that this court has never
all the statutes dealing with.
It says in public, Your Honor, but a conversation between two people on a street with no one within hearing distance at all, I submit, is still a private conversation, just as the telephone conversation in a public place
well,
in Cass
course,
your was
submission,
private.
Your submission has to include, I suppose, that the state may, that a person must, when he's walking down the street, put up with people accosting him or her for a deviant sexual purpose.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Well,
that's just about what you said a minute ago.
Do you think the solicitation or it may be very private, very quiet, very polite, but nevertheless, here's a person walking down the street who doesn't care to be solicited for a deviant sexual purpose and is very annoyed by it. Now, may the state forbid that or not?
The state may forbid it. And in the
how
hearing,
could it forbid it?
The state may forbid it by, in effect, adopting the kind of a statute which was approved in Commonwealth versus Sopranca and in prior the California decision, which I cite in my brief.
Well, would you say that it's illegal? You've committed a criminal act if you solicit a person on the street and he turns you down.
What you can say is...
Would that be all right?
No. No. The result...
So anyone must put up with being solicited on the street?
No, Your Honor. In Commonwealth versus Sopranca, I commend you to that case, and in the prior decision, what the court said was that you could not be convicted unless there was some reason to believe or some indication that there was someone present who would be offended thereby.
Well, the person who solicited is the one who's most offended.
But let me pose you these facts, if I may. Suppose I meet an individual and we have a discussion for 30 minutes, 45 minutes, whatever, and it quickly becomes apparent that we are both homosexuals and that he is interested, and
well,
therefore
that,
I extend an invitation.
That
how
may
can
be,
it be offense?
That may be fine, but I'm talking about
not
the person. Talking about the person who... turns him down. Now, and he's very annoyed by it. Can the man then be convicted for annoying this other person?
He can if there was an element of harassment or if there was
an element
of
harassment. He says, "I am harassed. I don't like to be walking down the street and be accosted by a homosexual."
The word accosted and the word...
Well, solicited by a homosexual.
If there is...
He came up to me very politely, very politely, and said, "Wouldn't you like to come over to my house?" Now, I take it you say the state may not forbid that.
I say that the state may not pass a law which blanketly forbids it in all circumstances regard to...
Well, may it forbid exactly what I said?
Yes, it may. If it is narrowly drawn...
So the state could say, It's illegal to solicit anybody. You've committed a criminal act if you solicit somebody who turns you down.
No. I'm sorry.
Or who turns you down and is annoyed.
No. It is not the result of the individual. It is illegal for you to solicit somebody if, under the circumstances, you had no reason to believe that they would be consensual towards that kind of a solicitation in terms of receiving the information.
So a fellow comes up and says, let me ask you a few questions. Is he off the hook then?
I think it's a factual question in every case, Your Honor. We can pose hypotheticals, but the real issue here is whether or not you can blanketly proscribe speech without requiring that there be some...
That's a straight overbreadth argument.
It may be. I would point out in that connection, somebody asked the district attorney what he was doing, whether he was just responding to our arguments in that regard. If your honors will look at the brief, you will see that the district attorney, and I don't fault him for this, has argued association, overbreadth, under-inclusiveness, and vagueness in his original brief to the court. On the basis that those issues were submitted to the court below, and it's difficult to determine whether they had an impact on the decision below or whether they would be before this court.
Well, the overbreadth argument certainly didn't have much of an impact.
That's the only one that you can say might not have had an impact, I think, because the only constitutional doctrine which the Court of Appeals mentions is one which it says it didn't use.
By implicitly or overtly?
I think that the argument that
the dissent said that they were really, in effect, applying overbreadth, and the majority said the dissent couldn't be more misguided.
We have to go back one step, if I may. We have to go back to determine what it was the court was doing. I submit to you that what the court below was doing was saying that the ultimate act had been converted into a legal, constitutionally protected act, and that, therefore, you couldn't forbid discussion about that act. Now, what we do not know is whether their statement to that effect is a First Amendment speech statement or whether it is an extension of the privacy concept.
But the Court of Appeals didn't say discussion. It said antecedent negotiation.
Solicitation. I don't know.
It certainly didn't use the term discussion, which might have lent some context or some support to the idea it was a First Amendment.
The whole case was about solicitation. The Court of Appeals was dealing with an actual solicitation. We don't know what the Court of Appeals meant or whether they were thinking in First Amendment terms because they didn't express it.
What they did say
was that since the ultimate act was not criminal, you can't punish the discreet invitation for that act.
What about heterosexual solicitation, to get to perhaps a somewhat different set? Can the state ban prostitute of either sex from soliciting intercourse in public, or soliciting money for intercourse, I should say?
Yes, I believe they can. I believe that when you get into commercial sex, that's a different area. I'm not arguing that prostitution is constitutionally protected at all.
And could it ban simply solicitation on the public streets of heterosexual sex?
You have the same principle then, Your Honor, if I may. If quite apart from whether they could effectively do it or not, the fact is that they do not attempt to ban solicitation of heterosexual sex unless
it is harassing.
Well, this
statute does exactly that, as I understand it. That is precisely what this statute does, and you have two respondents here, one of which apparently was involved in the heterosexual solicitation. And that is precisely what this statute does.
That gets into the area of the discrimination argument, Your Honor. We started out, and if you look at the trial court memorandum and opinion, it says that they only started going after the prostitutes after Onofre was decided. Although the statute is broadly written and could theoretically apply to any heterosexual sex, it does not apply to anyone else at all.
What difference does it make what the motivations were or what triggered the prosecution program? What's that got to do with the constitutional question?
Well, it has to do with the under-inclusiveness and denial of equal protection argument, which I made in my brief. But on this particular point, with Justice Rehnquist's inquiry, my response is the same. The state could prohibit public solicitation in a singles bar or elsewhere in a heterosexual situation. Put aside the commercial aspect, I think that's a different question. If you had a situation either where the individual was coming up unannounced, blatantly to somebody and issuing an invitation in what would have to be a harassing situation under the facts, but I don't think that they could extend it to the point of two acquaintances, for example, who happened to be sitting in a bar and one invited the other to go home for consensual sex. Again, you get to the point that there must be some type, when you're not dealing with ultimate criminal conduct, you get to some point where there has to be some type of freedom of speech and a narrowing of the writing of a statute which is going to restrict that freedom of speech.
Mr. Gardner, how do you present your issues? How do you make clear what issues you are presenting to the New York Court of Appeals? In your briefs, or do you file a paper initially petitioning for review?
No, you file the briefs. There is a petition for a leave to appeal to the
Right.
Court of Appeals.
And you state your grounds?
You state your grounds therein. But that does not become a part of the appeal record that is the case
decided
on.
So the grounds are your briefs?
That is correct.
And is your New York Court of Appeals brief in the record here, do you know?
No, I was told it couldn't properly go right into the record, but that the court could call for it if
right
it wished to do so.
Thanks.
And I have summarized in my brief the arguments that were raised and pointed to the pages of the brief before the Court of Appeals where those arguments were.
But the rules of the New York Court of Appeals require the parties to state what is the question presented on the first page, as we do here?
Yes, it does. Yes, they do, Your Honor.
And what did they say the question was?
In the opening of the briefs, the questions are stated. In other words,
is it set out as we do here?
No, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Might help the court find out what they're deciding.
In the petition for certiorari, Your Honor, you have a request for what the issues are that will be appealed. In our procedure, when you apply for permission to go to the Court of Appeals, you indicate what the issues are that are involved in this case that make it significant. You do not have to specify what the issues are specifically that will be decided. In your brief that you file with the Court of Appeals, you indicate those questions in detail. If the court calls for my brief, you will see how I have indicated those questions. I want to get back for just a moment to the construction argument. I would suggest to you that once there had been a construction of the statute in the narrowing way, indicating in effect that if you're looking for the problem of harassment of other people, and if you're looking for some of those other types of concerns that the state talks about, the problem with minors and things of that sort, there are other statutes. What the Court of Appeals said was this statute doesn't deal with that. This statute is part of the statutory scheme which was involved in the consensual sodomy law. And the legislature of the state of New York is free to deal with those other problems anytime they want to, as long as they write, to the extent that it imposes free speech restrictions, narrowly stated statutes that do not unduly impinge upon free communication.
Mr. Gardner, in that connection, I thought I understood you to say at the outset of your argument that the constitutional issue was here. And now I understand you to say that we are bound by the construction of the New York Court of Appeals, which...
Justice Powell, I think that what has happened...
Would not leave us free, perhaps, to consider any other question.
Justice Powell, what I'm saying is that the Court of Appeals has defined the scope of the statute.
Yeah.
And they've limited that. Then they have declared that statute as so defined unconstitutional. The issue as to whether it is constitutional as construed is before this court. But the court is bound by the construction, which does not encompass all of these other concerns with regard to harassment, offensiveness, children, and things of those other types of things that would be very critical in the correct case and involving the correct statute. In the brief that the state files, there is a considerable amount of, I would call, slipperiness as to whether we're dealing with speech or conduct. when we're dealing with a question of whether vagueness has been violated, the state tends to refer to the fact that there can only be an arrest if there's actual speech, actual solicitation. When we're dealing with a situation, however, where where I'm challenging the statute as being too vague, I'm challenging the statute as being a violation of the First Amendment rights, then we talk about the fact that it really deals with conduct. I would respectfully refer to the court and recommend the reading of a case which was published after the briefs were filed. The name of the case is Wirtz versus Risley, published by the in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in November 1983. That is, I have a citation. It was the Pocket Park came out in late December. It is 719 Fed Second 1438. That was a statute that dealt with the question of a threat and of conduct that tended toward intimidation. And the court specifically talked in terms of the fact that the ultimate act could generally only be committed by some type of communication. And therefore, it tended toward pure speech. And therefore, dealing with the issues under the First Amendment, dealing with the problem of overbreath being thrown up as an argument against the appellant, the court stated that first, there is pure speech, and we don't have to worry about overbreath, and even if we did, there is substantial overbreath here. I would submit to the court that there is substantial overbreath here as well, because although we have specifically here facts in this case regarding solicitation on North Street in Buffalo, what the state is arguing for is a general power to forbid any type of sexual invitation to come home, even in a gay bar, which is the fact pattern postulated in the reply brief.
Defending the Court of Appeals on a ground that they didn't rely on.
I am responding to the, I think the Court of Appeals relied on First Amendment free speech, although they didn't articulate it. And I'm anticipating that either my opponent or someone on this court will feel that I cannot argue that the First Amendment is involved beyond the narrow facts of my client's case because of the overbreath doctrine. I see the overbreath doctrine not as something which I raise in support of my case, but which others will raise against my position, and I'm pointing out to you that I do not believe it applies in this case in that manner. Thank you very much.
Do you have anything further, counsel?
Your Honor, I will waive my rebuttal.
Thank you, gentlemen.
The Honorable Court is now adjourned until Monday next at 10 o'clock.